Hello, this is Garrison Morado, host of the New Diplomatist podcast and author of the newdiplomatist.com blog, a trusted source of foreign policy news and insights, bringing factual analysis in the age of opinions. I'm so excited to announce that our blog is active once more with a new article this week on the year the European Union fell, analyzing the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the federal structure of Europe and the future of European integration. I hope you'll take time to go and visit thenewdiplomatist.com on Blogger. Also, I'm excited to announce Season 2 of the New Diplomatist podcast, starting with today's episode. Hope you enjoy. First, let's start with some headlines from today's latest news. Coronavirus response from NATO, the military alliance stepping up in the face of a global pandemic. Today, April 3rd, two Spanish military aircraft flew from Hamburg to Torreón Airport to deliver 50 ventilators sent by the German government as part of the ongoing collective security effort by NATO allies against the global pandemic of coronavirus. Spain had made this request, according to a news release from NATO, for assistance through NATO's Euro-Atlantic Disaster Response Coordination Center, a center that operates on a 24/7 basis and is currently assisting all the allies to cope with the consequences of major crises of a transnational nature, such as COVID-19's pandemic. The alliance is already coordinating supporting national efforts against the pandemic with logistical, transport, and medical help. And just yesterday, a video conference meeting of foreign ministers was convened for the first time to direct NATO's top commander, General Walters, to coordinate the necessary military support to combat the coronavirus crisis and start using fast-track paths through Europe's airspace for military flights carrying medical supplies. Barron's is reporting that the United States shed over 700,000 jobs in the month of March, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is now recommending the use of non-medical cloth face coverings to limit transmission of coronavirus, as also reported by Barron's. These instructions are completely voluntary at this time, according to President Donald Trump, who spoke during Friday's coronavirus task force briefing. He added that he would not be wearing the masks himself, but that it might help limit the spread at this stage of the pandemic. Today is a special episode of The New Diplomatist, as we will be reading the latest blog post from the blog. Again, that's titled The Year the European Union Fell, which you can also read yourself at thenewdiplomatist.com. But we'll be speaking through the content of that blog for this episode and discussing, in particular, the provocative notion that this is, in fact, the year the European Union fell. 2020 was one of the European Union's favorite years until it arrived. From the European Statistical System Review to the research-focused Horizon 2020 project, Brussels has for a long time looked to this year as a time of pivotal change and innovative development, a point on the calendar to mark a time of momentous goal reviews and system improvements. Then, of course, Boris Johnson became Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and purged the Conservatives' fractured ranks of all Remainers. Then he won an election to clear his hung Parliament and pave the way to a vote on the withdrawal agreement, and Britain left the European Union on January 31st. Now, obviously, Brexit was expected, but its sudden completion after so many years and months of delay caught the European Union off guard. You see, the leaders in Brussels were not fully convinced that the independent-minded Leave voters might be corralled back into its technocratic fold, but until Johnson's election, the leaders of the EU Commission had hopes of bringing the recalcitrant Brits back home. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, Britain has exited the European Union and there's no going back. And although negotiations continue on the final settlements for trade and the future of the relationship between the two powers, there's no question that Britain is out for good. This was a major blow to the European Union's hopes, and it demonstrated that although difficult, although challenging, and although lengthy, it was indeed possible for a nation to decide that the European project was no longer worth participating in and to withdraw from the auspices of Brussels. This does open the floodgates of perception. It may be delayed right now because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but in the future, other nations, particularly nations hard hit economically during this virus, like Italy, like Spain, their populations can look to Britain and say, you know what? They left the European Union and a major crisis struck, a health crisis, something that has long been pitched as something only the EU could help them handle, a transnational crisis. And you know what? The Brits did all right. Perhaps we can as well. Perhaps we don't need the European Union to succeed even in this global world. I'm getting ahead of myself. So in January, Britain exits from the European Union. Then in February, the German defense minister, known by her initials AKK, or Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, resigned as party leader of the Christian Democratic Union in Germany, thereby backed out of the running for chancellor. She was the heir apparent, the succession plan for Chancellor Angela Merkel, and with her departure from the party, departed the future stability of Europe's economic superpower, Germany. Suddenly, the political succession plans have become unclear, and with it, the leadership of Europe's most integral cog for economic development and for future economic innovation, in a continent that frankly has long been very stagnant when it comes to such matters outside of Germany. And finally, in March, the COVID-19 pandemic came to Italy, France, Germany, Portugal, and other nations throughout Europe, and the southern nations, which have only just in the last few years begun their full recovery from the Eurozone crisis just a decade earlier, have suddenly faced overwhelming medical demands from an incurable disease that has relentlessly killed thousands of their citizens. And the only solution has been to lock down those very economies that had just so recently begun to thrive again. Each of these challenges, month after month, have piled on the European Union as a project. And while each of these have no doubt already begun to be conquered by Europe, even if it's not yet apparent, they will with time and effort be overcome. But their impacts herald something deeper for this 26-nation bloc. With the foremost military power, Britain, gone, with the political leadership of the foremost administrative state, Germany, in murky waters, and with the largest tourist economies, France and Italy, in a total state of lockdown with the pandemic, and consumer confidence at a significant low, Europe needs supranational leadership from Brussels now more than ever to overcome the pain being inflicted on the national governments. But yet, ladies and gentlemen, that leadership hasn't come. Just when circumstances have seemed to be crying out for the kind of action that the EU has always boasted that a continental governance system could bring, that is a quick and unified transnational response to a transnational crisis, in this case a pandemic, Brussels has instead found itself flat-footed. As a matter of fact, 21 of the 26 EU members had enacted border controls before the European Commission ever took action. The leadership of the federal project find themselves in the back seat of a crisis beyond their grasp at a time when all those years of reviews have predicted that Brussels not only could captain Europe through a transnational crisis, but was the only safe option for Europe to proceed in a globalized world. And yet that has proven to be the exact opposite case. Now, to a shrewd observer, this is nothing new. The migrant crisis a few years ago set the continent on the edge of disunion, exposing that migration, as had often been proposed, was not in fact a strong suit for the bloc's transnational structure. Germany had to lead its recalcitrant neighbors headfirst into the migrant response by opening its borders to millions of refugees. It was as if the Germans were determined by brute force to show the world that the European Union really could succeed under catastrophic circumstances with a policy that was human rights first and security second. And to an extent, they succeeded in maintaining the coherence of the European Union, but at a cost. Yet, it is the coronavirus pandemic and not the migrant crisis that has for the first time succeeded in truly isolating the European capitals from Brussels. Even internationalist Germany, with its idealistically pragmatic chancellor, has not opened itself up during this crisis, has in fact sealed itself in, paradoxically, in a completely different response from the migrant crisis just a few years earlier. The result? This new shifting of power from Brussels to the regional capitals has begun. The nations of Europe no longer feel they can wait for the EU Commission and the EU Parliament to take the actions necessary to counter swift-moving transnational crises. Even the Germans, the most ardent believers of the European project, the most important cog in the economic structure that is the Schengen zone, have decided to seal off their borders in order to protect their citizens. And they did so not at the behest of Brussels, but leading Brussels' decision-making. The result of this new shifting of power from Brussels to regional capitals, well, it's not yet clear. It's not clear how far this goes, what other topics it applies to. But it is in no way evident that the power structure will return leadership to the EU Commission when the pandemic crisis has passed. It's not yet April. And there are many shocks left on the horizon for the world's only monetary and political transnational union. Now, consider this with me. If President Trump wins re-election, if Iran restarts its nuclear ambitions, if Russia seizes Belarus, as they are rumored to do, or if terrorism makes a resurgence inside the continent, or any combination of the above, the European Union may indeed find itself struggling to cope with pressures from without and within, not from a policy perspective, but because for the very first time since the inception of the modern European Union, the nations of Europe are taking the lead in a way that is independent of, and disregarding to, and out of order with the technocratic visions of Brussels. Indeed, this may be the year the European Union as we know it falls, and the nations of Europe rise once more. Now, what does all of this mean for America's relationship to the 27-nation EU bloc? And by the way, it is 27 nations. I believe earlier I might have said 26. Post-COVID-19, what does the United States do to relate to a Europe where power is shifting from Brussels at the transnational level back to the regional capitals? Well, first and foremost, the United States needs to rebalance its expectations. For decades, the U.S. has been supportive of the European project because they believed that it was something that could be steered to their economic benefit. Via a partnership, and a very strong historic partnership in the Atlantic Alliance with Britain, mirrored and deepened by the NATO alliance with so many of the other nations of Western Europe and now Eastern Europe, America felt that they could maintain control over European security policy, counter the influence of Russia, and steer the EU economically from the inside with Britain's reasonable pro-American voice at the table, ensuring that the EU becomes a strong, stable, prosperous trading partner, preventing any further European continental wars while creating a massive market for European goods, technological services, etc. But now that Britain has left the European Union, there is a Franco-Germanic condominium, that is, there is a two-nation leadership at the top of the European Union. I'm not talking about the formal structure with the EU Commission and with the EU Parliament. We know that there are various mechanisms that the EU runs by. But in reality, everyone knows that the Chancellor of Germany and the President of France have an outsized voice in the proceedings of the European Union project. And now that they stand at the helm of leadership without the British Prime Minister involved in negotiations, without the British Prime Minister's voice at the table for the future of Europe, France and Germany's vision will prevail over those of the more moderate states, such as Poland, Hungary, those states such as Norway, who exist on the periphery of the project. They have long looked to Britain to be the moderating voice for the French and Germans' tendency to go more unified basis, to have more of a federalized European state, as opposed to Britain's confederated view of the European Union. With Britain gone, those states, Norway, Poland, Hungary, they are no longer as well represented at the table, and the United States is no longer as well represented at the table. And so the U.S., as well as those other nations on the periphery, such as Poland and others, they should focus on individual bilateral ties to various states in Europe. The United States should make overtures to connect directly with Italy, to connect directly with Spain, directly with Portugal, directly with Poland, and not to entirely ignore the European Union, but to reprioritize the ordering of its foreign policy relationships to focus on individual relationships with nations and less on the bloc, because it is my prediction that the EU will continue to wane in its influence and in its success as they have to deal with the economic fallout, the economic slowdown that will come as a result of the tourist-based economies of Southern Europe being hammered by this pandemic. The EU is going to have its hands full just trying to stay above water. America should focus its efforts not on the broken systems of transnational union in Europe, but instead should focus with the individual governments that are taking the lead in the COVID-19 fight and who will continue, I believe, who will continue to execute their newfound independence within the European structure to steer their nations in a budgetary sense, in an economic policy sense, in a military sense, and security, in their entire national outlooks, I believe will become more independent post-COVID-19 than they ever were before, and Brussels will have less influence. And therefore, America should preemptively recognize this shifting of power and not fight it, but embrace it, the newfound opportunity to conduct bilateral relations rather than multilateral ones with Brussels. Secondly, I believe the U.S. should focus on Brexit and ensuring that there is a path forward. President Donald Trump believes that he is a strong negotiator. He has demonstrated his ability to work new deals. We can quibble over whether the deals have been a success or not thus far, whether or not they were well-structured deals compared to what had existed previously, but there is no arguing that he has significantly realigned American trade policy, what with the new deal with China, Part 1, already enacted, what with the USMCA supplanting NAFTA, what with the new US-South Korean trade agreement, and now a pending US-UK trade agreement is on the books. President Trump and the US government should recognize the weakness of Brussels at this time and seek to help Britain get a good deal in the US-UK trade agreement, make it good for American farmers, make it good for American technology companies in particular, who have been so persecuted by Brussels during the last few years with draconian fines and so on. Work out a good deal with the Brits, but also give them some wins. Make it easy for their parliament to swallow the trade pill. Don't push them too hard. Embrace Britain. Help guide them in such a way that they can build up the strength of their newly independent economy and finish negotiating with Brussels this year on their trade agreement from a position of strength, knowing that their trade deal with us is assured and allowing them a soft landing spot as they exit into the world. In this way, we will increase our bilateral relations with the various nations in Europe, and we will also increase our ability to relate with newly independent Britain and give them an upper hand in negotiations with Brussels during a time where the EU's influence is beginning to wane. And lastly, we must be on the lookout against China's preemptive invasion, economically speaking, of Europe during this time of crisis. China has already been pouring billions of dollars of investment into their One Belt, One Road project, which includes many of the nations in southeastern and southern Europe. We must be even more on the lookout that in the wake of a tourist economy collapse because of the COVID-19 pandemic, that the U.S. stands ready and willing to invest in European businesses on a nation-by-nation basis, prepared to step into the gap economically, perhaps even with a new Marshall Plan of sorts on a smaller, more smartly allocated modern 21st century scale to counter China's economic influence and not permit the Communist Party to operate any greater influences from Beijing over Southern Europe. If we can counter China, if we can assist the Brits during Brexit with trade, and if we can establish stronger bilateral ties with the European Union, I believe that America will have learned the lessons of the COVID-19 pandemic response from a foreign policy outlook, that an engaged and active America can simultaneously not step back from the world, but still do what is in its best interests and in the interests of its allies. In a sense, we can have our cake and eat it too if we're willing to make some smart and strategic moves to adjust to the circumstances that now present themselves to us. Thanks so much for joining me for episode 1 of the new season of the New Diplomatist podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please give us a good rating on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you may be listening to us, whatever platform. Leave us a good review, leave us a comment, give us your feedback, and please, while you're at it, visit thenewdiplomatist.com for even more great resources. Until next episode, I'm Garrison Rotter, your host, and stay safe.